That's Bix Beiderbecke, a cornet player, pianist, and composer from Davenport, Iowa. Beiderbecke made a name for himself as a gifted horn player who could swing back in the 1920s, but he died young of alcoholism. Frederick Turner writes about Beiderbecke's life in his new book called 1929, A Novel of the Jazz Age. He read Steve Paulson a passage from the book about the night Beiderbecke's band, the Gene Goldcat Band, challenged the reigning champions, the Fletcher Henderson Band.
Roseland was packed with penguins. Every musician in town turned out in boiled shirts and black tuxedos to watch Henderson and his boys, Joe Smith, Benny Carter, Coleman Hawkins, and Armstrong's replacement, Rex Stewart, carve up the corn-fed white boys from the sticks. And somehow, Chalice can't remember how, it had been determined that the Henderson Band would have the first shot. They opened with the fiery stampede. Stewart and Smith featured, and the whole band tight together, joyously shouting to each other in a call-and-response pattern between the brass and the reeds. Big sound of applause from the floor, and the dancers delighted, and the penguins murmuring, "Oh boy, I gotta watch this." The boys on the stand smiling between numbers, mopping their faces, and Henderson himself cool, imperially elegant. And when they'd finished, the din in the place was huge. And Chalice remembers thinking, "Well, I've done what I could, but that's tough to beat, really tough." And remembers, too, looking at the drummer Chauncey Morehouse and finding something missing in his face, that invincible confidence they'd all come in here with. But then he found it again, radiating out of the faces of the others, Murray and Bix and Tram, who was wearing that same tight, funny little half-smile he'd worn at the Riverside Barn, that lopsided look that was both grin and grimace, and that said to the others, "Let's not get into a sweat over that. They've had their best shot. Now it's our turn." And then he heard Tram talking to them all while he, Chalice, stood off to the side with Goldcat himself and Herman Weiss. And Tram was explaining the strategy of a decoy and how it might be kind of nice to sucker everybody with their first number, play something sweet, even slightly schmaltzy. And his little grin cracked open just a bit more when he said, "Valencia." And then they all got it, got the spirit of the thing, the essence of the ploy, which could only be ventured if they knew the power they had in reserve. And they had it all right, and they had the kid with the cornet. And when they'd struck into the sedate 6-8 tempo of Valencia, a sound came to them up from the floor, the mingled sound of surprise and disappointment and the negative satisfaction, too, that was the crowd's response to a challenge unanswered. And there were smiles all around out there now, and nowhere broader than over on the adjacent stand, where the Henderson boys settled into their chairs and relaxed, and a couple of them even laughed. "Cute guys, they aren't going to take us on straight. They're going to try to slip our punch, cute white guys." And the applause after Valencia was good, generous, because they played it well, you had to give them that. Still. And then Chalice had heard Tram call Babyface, one of Chalice's best and hottest. And Tram had told him not to take down, but to go from Babyface right into Blue Room, and not to stop there either, but to keep on going, right into My Pretty Girl. And by the time they reached My Pretty Girl, the smiles were gone from the boys there on the adjacent stand, and Joe Smith was staring over at Bix and saying something in Rex Stewart's ear, and Stewart was turning his cornet in his hands like it was something he wished he could hide somewhere just now, and the crowd was hollering, and the penguins in their boiled shirts and tuxedos were laughing out loud, and Chalice found that he was laughing too, laughing in the sheer joy of the moment that in some part of his mind he understood even then was unrepeatable, that no matter what future success beckoned, there'd never be another this. And in that instant, Bix had turned his head and looked at Chalice, his face shining like a young god, if a young god could bite his lower lip to keep from laughing. And Chalice had nodded, still laughing, and Bix had nodded back in acknowledgement and winked, telling him, "We have a lot to do. This is just the beginning."
That's terrific. Thank you. Well, let me follow up on that passage. So what happened in that battle of the bands between the Gene Goldcat Orchestra and Fletcher Henderson's group? It sounds like Goldcat demolished them.
Well, they did, actually. I don't make anything out of that in the novel, but if we can, you know, distinguish now between historical fact and fiction, which I want to continue to do, you know, since that's what I'm writing, fiction, not fact. But the fact of the matter is, at least in the recollections of everybody on both sides, both the Henderson boys and the Goldkett band, it was that the Goldkett band really wiped them up.
And that was kind of unusual, wasn't it, for the white boys to come in and show that they could play pretty well?
It was a big surprise, and I think nobody was more surprised than Rex Stewart. In fact, I think Stewart was the one who acknowledged most straightforwardly what had happened that night.
Now, who was Rex Stewart?
Rex Stewart was the cornet player who had replaced Louis Armstrong in the Fletcher Henderson band. He's one of the few guys, particularly one of the few black players, who frankly acknowledged what a great influence Bix had been on him.
What kinds of relationships did black and white jazz musicians have back in the 20s?
Well, they never played together, that's for starters. The bands were entirely segregated, and they were really up until the 30s. And I think maybe Benny Goodman bringing Lionel Hampton and Teddy Wilson into his band and Artie Shaw bringing Billie Holiday into his, those were the real breakthroughs. They jammed together after hours. Armstrong and Bix were great admirers of each other, and they jammed together after hours, but they never played together professionally.
Hmm. Now, it's worth pointing out that Bix Beiderbecke was almost an exact contemporary of Louis Armstrong, wasn't he?
Yes.
Now, how would you compare their styles of playing?
To compare their styles of playing? Well, Armstrong is a far more powerful pyrotechnic player than Bix ever was. I mean, it was nothing for Armstrong, you know, play 30 choruses, you know, of high C. He could do it. He was incredible. Bix always played in the range of basically of a singer's voice. He didn't have nearly the range or the power of Armstrong. What he had was an unusual sense of phrasing and an inimitable tone. And I think the best thing that was ever said about Bix was from Armstrong. He said, "They all try to play like Bix. Ain't nobody play like him yet." And he's absolutely true. He's absolutely accurate there.
Let me back up for a moment. Why did you decide to write a novel about Bix Beiderbecke?
What I saw was that this was a parable of an artist who came of age just as America had become a fully modern culture, right after World War I. And I saw this country as emerging from that war, the most militarily powerful nation, the richest nation, and devoted to more of everything. More money, more speculation, more speed, the automobile and the airplane, more noise, the Victrola, more home runs, Babe Ruth, more of everything. And so here's this guy from Davenport, Iowa, self-taught, with a very narrow but very beautiful talent, trying to make his way in this ferociously modern culture, and of course he's bound to get lost, and he does get lost. That's the story that I wanted to write, so the only thing I could do, the only way I could write that was to invent.
Now, you said that Bix came from Davenport, Iowa, which seems a rather unlikely place for a major jazz talent to originate from. How do you explain that?
Well, these things are never easy to explain. The handiest explanation, the one that comes most often to mind, is that the riverboats played Davenport on their way northward from New Orleans. And these had some of the really great early black jazz players on them. Now, how much Bix actually heard of that, nobody really knows. There's a legend that he met Armstrong when the boat played Davenport, and he probably did, but that's not really a sufficiently comprehensive explanation. I think there was that influence, the bands coming there, but also we have to factor in the advent of the Victrola and the records. And we do know that Bix's brother, Bernie, brought back some records from his years in the service after World War I. And that Bix heard these, and particularly heard the original Dixieland jazz band, which was anything but. But certainly it made an enormous influence on him.
Now, Bix Beiderbecke joined the Gene Goldkett band and later the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. What was life like for those kinds of groups, being on the road a lot?
Well, it's easier to speak about the Whiteman band because the Goldkett band broke up pretty soon after Bix joined it. And the easiest thing to say about the Whiteman schedule, it was a killer. They toured all year long, and if they weren't touring, they were in the studio. And if they weren't in the studio or touring, they were on the radio. So it was tremendously demanding schedule. Of course, you know, it's one thing to play the piano or the violin, but the wind instruments are tremendously athletic instruments. You know, night after night, day after day, to do that, it takes its toll. A lot of these guys broke down. A lot of them drank just so they could go through it.
And certainly Big Spiderbeck drank himself to death in the end.
He did, yes. Of course, you have to remember, too, they were drinking terribly toxic stuff. I mean, it's not like they were drinking Jack Daniels.
What were they drinking?
Prohibition, illegal liquor that was filled with all sorts of additives to disguise how really terrible it was. And some of this stuff made you go blind. And so, I mean, it would not be allowed in any civilized country now.
When did things get really hard for Bix? When did he start sinking into some kind of decline because of his alcohol problem?
I'd say the year would be 29. By that point, Bix was a confirmed alcoholic. You know, some people pulled out of it or could skate along the edge of it. All those guys drank heavily. Bing Crosby drank heavily, but Bing Crosby didn't become an alcoholic.
And Bix died incredibly young.
Yeah.
What was he, 28?
Yeah. 28. That's hitting it pretty hard.
Now today, there's an annual Bix Lives Festival in his hometown of Davenport, Iowa. Have you ever been there?
I have.
What's it like there?
Hot. A lot of corn. But it's a lot of fun.
So is Bix kind of a hometown hero still?
In an odd way. You know, he's a celebrated son, but there is this kind of pall about him or a shadow that follows him maybe because he was an alcoholic and because he died in impoverished and lonely circumstances. There's a certain sense of edginess, I think, that's there as well. But I think over the years, that aspect of his life has receded a little bit and much more attention is paid to his talent.
Frederick Turner is the author of 1929, a novel of the jazz age. He spoke with Steve Paulson.